Good afternoon. Good afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Alan Adams. I'm chairman of the Board of Governors of the National Press Club and an editor with Research Recommendations. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind our members of upcoming speakers. Tomorrow, Thursday, November 9, Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbott will be on hand to discuss the Clinton administration's Bosnian policy. On Thursday, November 16, choreographer Jacques D'Amboise, founder of the Nashville Dance Institute, will address the press club audience. And on Tuesday, November 21, Grammy Award-winning trumpeter Wynton Marsalis will talk about his role as artistic director of jazz at the Lincoln Center and teaching young people about jazz music. Transcripts and audio and video tapes of press club luncheons are available by calling 1-800-NPC-2334. The National Press Club is also pleased to announce the publication of a new book, The National Press Club's Best Contemporary Speakers, a book containing 13 of the best speeches made during 1994. To order a copy, this is it. To order a copy, call 1-800-NPC-2334. If you have any questions for our speaker, please write them on the cards distributed at your table and pass them up to me. I will ask as many as time permits. I'd now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. From your right, Tammy Lytle, New Haven Register. Bob Geiger, Lexington Herald Leader. Tom Ferrero, Bloomberg News Service. Susan Swain, Senior Vice President, C-SPAN. Chuck Greener, Director of Communications, Republican National Committee. Ken Bodie, host of Washington Week in Review. And skipping over one of our speakers, Mark Johnson, Media General News Service, and Chairman, National Press Club Speakers Committee. Again, skipping our speaker. Reginald Stewart, Assistant News Editor, Knight Ritter Newspapers, and member of the National Press Club Speakers Committee who arranged today's luncheon. Diane Reese, Press Secretary, Democratic National Committee. Charles Lewis, Washington Bureau Chief, ABC News. Jose Carreno, El Universal. And Jeff Winograd, Editor and Publisher, Yellow Dog Democrat. And I'd like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Pat Nelson, Melanie Abdar-Dermott, and Howard Rothman for arranging today's luncheon. It's the morning after, and how does America's political landscape look? If you ask a smiling Senator Christopher Dodd, seated to my left, he might say it looks rosier than it has in many months. The Democrats, you see, fended off what many observers had expected would be another election day romped by Republicans, still euphoric over their sweep of Congress this time a year ago. In Virginia, Democrats defeated a full-blown effort by Republicans to take control of both houses of the legislature. The GOP scored in Mississippi, where incumbent Republican governor was reelected, but voters put Democrats in all other posts by decisive margins and rejected term limits. In Kentucky, the Democratic candidate for governor, he won, and in Maine, voters gave Democrats control of the House of Representatives. Looking ahead, Mr. Dodd might say his party is in a better position than its rivals in at least one respect. They are pretty sure who their nominee for president will be. If you ask a not-so-jubilant Haley Barbour, seated to my right, he might say perhaps voters are pausing over the Republican Revolution, but he has faith in his part that his party will persevere in the end. But Mr. Barbour's party faces a dogfight over its nomination for president next year. And I would ask both of you, what is the impact of Mr. Powell's apparent decision, as reported by the Associated Press, that he will not be a candidate? Mr. Powell is due to report or confirm or whatever that news from AP at a 3 o'clock press conference. We'll hear two versions of what Tuesday's elections meant and next year's outlook contest will look like from two professionals who should know what they're talking about. Senator Dodd of Connecticut is co-chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Mr. Dodd, first elected to the Senate in 1980, is the man in charge of helping his party recover from its disastrous losses in Congress last year and its slippage in state and local houses, and hoping to keep the White House. If you ask a not-so-jubilant Mr. Barbour about the outcome of the race, he is the man who must juggle the party that is surging with enthusiasm over its soaring clout in American politics, but with a long list of multiplying candidates. I'll spare you long introductions to these party leaders, except to say that they are seasoned, respected political activists. Senator Dodd, who has served in elected politics most of his career, and Mr. Barbour, a grassroots political operative who worked his way to the top. Before they begin, let me explain today's rules of engagement. During a reception preceding this lunch, and actually it came later with the arrival of Mr. Dodd, we had a coin toss to determine who would speak first. Senator Dodd won the toss and decided to speak first. After he finishes, Mr. Barbour will speak, and then each will offer an 8-minute statement and 5-minute rebuttal. Then we'll follow with your questions. Ladies and gentlemen, the National Press Club marks the start of our 1966 political program this year with Mr. Dodd to discuss the 1996 election. Who's winning and who's losing? Senator Dodd.
Well, thank you very, very much, and I appreciate Mr. Adams, your invitation to be here before the press club and to be sharing the podium with my colleague, Haley Barbour, and I appreciate the unique lunch of chicken, something which I rarely get on the campaign tours. Let me begin by briefly stating that there is a danger here in obviously overstating a case when you have an off-year elections in three or four or five states and to try and read more into them than may be the case. So I want to begin by stating that while certainly this was a very, very good day yesterday for Democrats across the country from Mississippi to Maine, certainly this party, the Democratic Party, doesn't take the message as somehow a complete victory in the sense that we can sit back and relax, that 1996 is going to work out just fine. We've got a lot of work to do. The message is an encouraging one, one that I think will energize the party across the country at the grassroots level, but we still have a lot of work to do. Let me share with you what I think were some of the broad themes in these races, and I'm going to emphasize not so much the showcase races as the lowercase races, because if you're going to look for trends, I think those races are more instructive about message that may have been coming from the voters in the states where those elections occurred. Certainly, first of all, there's no doubt, and if you look at the emphasis that was placed on the part of Republican candidates and Democratic candidates in most of these states to nationalize the themes locally, that Speaker Gingrich was a very important personality in these races. In virtually every state, he was a focal point of attention. And certainly the revolution, the contract on America with America was certainly a major item of discussion. I would conclude, based on the results in these races, that the Gingrich revolution has certainly been stalled, if not sidetracked, by the voters' response to those contesting messages. Secondly, the substantive debate that's going on in Washington, which again was a major subject of debate and discussion in these states on Medicare, Medicaid, education, the environment, again, a very strong and profound message coming from the voters in these states that you're going too far with this agenda. It's extreme. It's going far beyond what most Americans think that we ought to be doing with regard to their education of their children, their long-term health care needs, the environment, jobs, and the like. Thirdly, this is certainly a turning point for Democrats. Well, we've been through a difficult year since the congressional races of 1994, and certainly, as I said a moment ago, going to energize the party tremendously. But it's also a turning point for the American people. This is a critical message, I think, they're sending to, again, the political community here in Washington and elsewhere, and that is slow down, you're going too far. This is also an important message to this party, the Democratic Party, to the South. We have been told over and over again that the South is no longer a place where Democrats could be competitive. I think we've disproved that yesterday. The races in Kentucky, Mississippi, and Virginia certainly are critical testing grounds for the Republican Party. If they could have picked three states, they couldn't have done much better given the predictions of how they would do and particularly where they tested the national Republican message. Lastly, regarding General Powell, because today certainly has not only been a good day for Democrats in terms of the message coming back, but also the double message that apparently we're going to receive. That is the voters saying yesterday, we think you're heading in the wrong direction, Washington, with your agenda, but also an announcement that may come in a couple of hours from General Powell that says that there doesn't seem to be room for me in this Republican Party. A sign virtually hung out that says moderates need not apply. But the suggestion that this Republican Party is a big tent party, I think will be described aptly today as a pup tent party in many ways, given the fact that that we've seen the extreme right reject Colin Powell in a vicious attack last week by the leaders of the various extreme groups within that party. Let me just briefly run down these states. In Kentucky, a close race for governor, but again, here's 28 years of Democratic control in that state. Term limits, change is an important message. We've seen that. The fact that Governor-elect Patton overcame that, the tobacco issue was important in that state. Larry Forgey constantly talked about President Clinton. A referendum, in fact, specifically said, let's send a message to reject the reelection of President Clinton. The fact that it was a close race is not surprising. But once you get below the gubernatorial race, Democrats from Auditor, Agricultural Commissioner, Secretary of State, Attorney General, swept by more than 100,000 votes in that state. This, I think, is a far more important message in terms of you're trying to decide which party the people in that state ally themselves with more closely. That was also the case in Mississippi. We were 20 points behind in the gubernatorial race just a couple of weeks ago. I regret that we didn't have a better sense on how close that race might have become. We might have even put more resources into it. But the lieutenant governor, the Republican, was rejected. Again, statewide Democrats were elected overwhelmingly. In fact, one Republican who switched parties was defeated yesterday in Mississippi in one of those legislative races. In Virginia, Democrats have lost 10 of the last 11 presidential races in the state of Virginia. This was a state where a popular incumbent governor stumped the state from one end to the other. Massive resources were poured into that state to try and turn back 100 years of history of Democratic control in the legislature, and it failed. It failed. And even if you go below the legislative races into the Board of Education races, it was also a rejection, I think, of the Christian right extreme coalition there in terms of their desire to change policies even at that level. You go to New Jersey, in Hudson County, 17 mass mailings spent to try and unseat the incumbents there, one going away in that race. Guy Molinari in Staten Island in New York. There, the race, we used the Gingrich ads, morphing into Guy Molinari, rejected in Staten Island. In my home state of Connecticut, we had three incumbent Republican mayors that were rejected in that state that were fairly popular in their communities. So I think there is a message here, and it comes back again. I don't think it was so much a question of mechanics or bumper stickers or buttons, but it was a message about the agenda here in Washington, the contract. When people had a clear idea of what those choices were, they've rejected this contract. And if I were the leadership today in the Republican Party, I'd be redrafting my ideas on Medicare and education, the environment, because if they stick with those messages, then I think 1996 is going to be a strong year for Democrats.
Barber, your 8 minutes.
Thank you, Bud. Thank you all very much. In the 5 states with major elections this year, we Republicans will achieve a 3-1-1 record. I'd love to have won them all, but the victories our candidates won is something I'm certainly happy to settle for. We reelected a Republican governor of Mississippi by a record margin, maintained a huge percentage in the New Jersey Assembly for an unprecedented third election in a row, broke the record for Republican seats in the Virginia Senate and tied for control of it for the first time in history, received 49%+ of the vote, more than at any time since 1967 in the Kentucky governor's race, and we're poised to win the Louisiana governor's race on November the 18th. That's a very good year based solely on the support voters gave us yesterday. But it's particularly a good year when compared to the Democrats. Things have been so bad for the Democrats, they've set a new standard for success. They're crowing that they're only going to lose half their Democrat governorships this year. While yesterday's results primarily are attributable to the candidates and state issues, the national environment continues to be a plus for Republicans. The only Democrat winner, Paul Patton, in the Kentucky governor's race, ran as a conservative, advocated tax cuts, said government should be smaller, called for an overhaul of the current Democrat administration's education reform law, opposed gun control, supported prayer in schools, proposed building more prisons and implementing the death penalty. Patton even publicly opposed President Clinton on regulating tobacco as a narcotic and said he would not support Clinton for re-election if he followed through with it. Another telltale sign of how bad things are for the Democrats nationally is that President Clinton did not make a single campaign appearance for any Democrat candidate in any state. In contrast, the increasing strength of support for our party shows in the results. In most cases, we either had the best result ever in the states or the best result in a generation. Mississippi Governor Kirk Fordyce won by a double-digit margin and received the highest vote for a Republican gubernatorial candidate in the state's history. He's the first Mississippi governor to be reelected in this century. Even in defeat, Larry Forgy got the highest percentage of the vote for any Republican candidate for governor of Kentucky in 28 years. In the New Jersey legislative races, Republicans had the best showing ever in a midterm election by the party in power. No party has won 50 or more assembly seats in 3 consecutive elections in New Jersey history. So our 50-30 margin is historic, and it gives Governor Christy Whitman over 60% support in both houses of the New Jersey legislature. Republicans had hoped to win control of the Virginia Senate, but the 2-seat gain that resulted left us with a tie. 20-20. Obviously, Governor Allen would have liked to have had one more, and I'd have liked to have had one more. But this is the most Republicans ever to serve in the Virginia legislature. We have never had a majority in either house of the Virginia legislature. Ties are like kissing your sister, but I can tell you ties better than losing. Next week, Republican Mike Foster is heavily favored to win the governorship in Louisiana away from the Democrats. We've already gained seats in the legislature in Louisiana, and more Republican gains are expected in the November 18th runoff. There are lessons for Republicans, both in our victories and in our defeat. Where the campaigns turned on issues, we won. Governor Fordyce has cut spending, fought for income tax cuts, eliminated the state's capital gains tax altogether, implemented strict work requirements for welfare, and put state prisoners to work. His conservative record was the centerpiece of his campaign, and he won in a record landslide. New Jersey Assembly candidates emphasized the Republican record of tax cuts and spending constraint. Virginia legislative elections were driven by Governor Allen's agenda and Democrat opposition to it. In Louisiana, we have a classic race between a conservative Republican and a liberal Democrat. When the focus is on issues, Republicans usually win. Only in Kentucky did the outcome turn on something besides issues. And this loss is also very instructive to Republicans for next year's election. The race in Kentucky was a seesaw affair, often literally tied in the polls. In fact, the last tracking poll numbers for November 2nd through November 5th showed a dead heat. In late September, our candidate, Larry Forgy, had fallen behind by 11 points in the Bluegrass poll published by the Louisville Courier-Journal. From late September to late October, Forgy steadily wiped out that Democrat lead and forged ahead in the tracking polls. During the period Forgy moved into the lead, when he made a net 17-point gain in the polls, Forgy focused on state issues, and that's when the Democrats, and that is exactly when the Democrats were attacking him and the Republicans on Medicare. That line of attack flopped, so the Democrats changed tactics. On October 23rd, the Democratic candidate, Paul Patton, told the media he was, quote, going negative, close quote, and, quote, it's not going to be pretty. And was he ever right? Patton's campaign hit Forgy with a very effective negative spot that essentially said Forgy was a crook. It had nothing to do with national issues or state issues. It was a purely ad hominem attack. And it knocked Forgy down 6 points in the polls in 5 days. Forgy ultimately recovered most of it and almost caught back up. This personal attack campaign is instructive for Republicans because it is so similar to what Ted Kennedy used to defeat Mitt Romney in Massachusetts and what Lawton Childs ran against Jeb Bush in Florida. Last year, Tony Coelho, who was my counterpart at that time, told Democrats to run negative attack campaigns. The 94-95 results show that this has been their most effective strategy, and our Republican candidates are going to have to learn to expect that kind of advertising next year. You know, we've already seen in the Wall Street Journal the article about the Clinton campaign so-called Nasty Boys campaign team, where the Nasty Boys talk about how terror is effective as a campaign tactic because it's easier to scare people. So we, as we prepare for next year, here's what we think you can look for. Expect Republicans to run on the issues: smaller government, lower taxes, less spending, fewer regulations, genuine welfare reform, tough criminal justice reforms, and so on. People agree with the Republicans on the issues, so issues will continue to be the foundation of our campaign. The Democrats, on the other hand, will want to talk about anything but the issues. They'll want to talk about anything besides what they're for. The Clinton administration and the Democrats in Congress are bereft of ideas. They've offered no budget that balances. In fact, no Democrat would offer President Clinton's budget for a vote in Congress. And when a Republican senator offered it, it lost 96-0. No Democrat senator would even vote for President Clinton's budget. That's an example of being bereft of ideas. President Clinton's flip-flopped so much on taxes, welfare, and everything else that it's the Democrats and liberal columnists who are criticizing and ridiculing him. In light of what Clinton and the Democrats in Congress are doing or not doing, looking at their Medicare campaign from this year and learning the lesson of the 1995 elections, it's clear how the Clinton reelection campaign will be waged. It'll be the most negative presidential campaign in history and will feature Bill Clinton running away from his record. Indeed, it will probably feature Bill Clinton running away from Bill Clinton like a scalded dog. Now that should be interesting. Thank you.
Senator Dodd, you have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Yeah, I was disappointed. I thought Haley was going to get through without referring to Teddy Kennedy or a scalded dog and that whole thing. But you got them both in, Haley. I admire that very much. Well, let me just pick up the challenge. First of all, negative ads from the party that gave us Willie Horton. I'm a little disingenuous in terms of these. Now, I hope we can avoid negative campaigns, and we're more than happy to have this race over the next 12 months be conducted on the issues. Because, again, come back to the point, if you look at the ads that were run and the debates, and listen to Paul Patton last evening when he declared victory and his statements saying no, this election was a resounding no to Newt Gingrich and no to Bob Dole, and no to the extreme cuts and programs that affect working people. We have a tendency to underestimate the ability of the American public to read and to understand what some of these debates are about. Every national survey that's been done in the last several months, over 80% of the American public have said that they believe that the Republican agenda in Congress goes too far. We made that a critical part of our debate this fall. In states where, frankly, we've been told that we need not bother any longer, even bothering to campaign in, because we couldn't have any chances of winning. And yet in Mississippi, the home state of my colleague, the Republican national chairman, aside from the gubernatorial race, where we did make it competitive, remember, 20 points behind, even 2 weeks ago. And there we did, the voters in that state did reject the incumbent Republican lieutenant governor. We built the majorities in the state legislature, in the state of Mississippi. In Kentucky, as I mentioned earlier, expanding our opportunities there. It wasn't because we had the same degree of resources. In Mississippi, we were outspent substantially by almost $1 million. In Virginia, outspent 2-1. Newt Gingrich and Bob Dole campaigned in Virginia, in these states, and campaigned on their agenda. The governor of Virginia said, what I want for Virginia is exactly what is happening at the national level, a mini contract. That's what he campaigned on. And yet we saw the rejection despite the resource commitments. Now, we will accept the challenge to debate these issues in 96 and make 96 a referendum on the Medicare, education, environment issues that are the centerpiece, and the huge tax cuts that are the centerpiece of the contract with America. We think the public will reject that, as they did in these states over the last several weeks and the campaigns. Again, even in Maine, where we regained control of the legislature in two legislative races there, demonstrating that this message works across the country and that people want to see Democrats stand up and fight back, that they believe this is wrong-headed, going in the wrong direction. If Democrats stick with these messages and taking on these extreme proposals, then I think we have a winning message and a campaign for 1996. I also think there's a message here for the Speaker of the House, who is the leader of this revolution. This is a figure that has the highest negative ratings of any national political figure in the United States. A further, I think, expression of how people feel about how far this agenda is going from outside of the mainstream that Americans are looking for. This administration has done a remarkable job on the basic economic issues, and it is reflected not by what politicians say, but how Main Street and Wall Street are reacting to it. This is one of the strongest economies in memory. We find the size of government shrinking. The interest rates are down. Jobs are up in this country. There is a tremendously positive response to the direction we're going in. In fact, in Mississippi, one of the reasons there's a strong economy there is not because of what the incumbent governor has done, but because of national policies, which have lowered interest rates and created economic opportunity in that state. In fact, Governor Fordyce is a beneficiary of the positive things that have occurred at the national level. We did not, to the extent we did in Virginia, Kentucky, and elsewhere, nationalize the race. I wish we had, frankly. Had we more aggressively nationalized the race in Mississippi, I think we might have even made that closer and potentially won that race, where we're told we didn't have the slightest chance.
Beauty, of course, is in the eye of the beholder. Let me just say about, since this is time for rebuttal, I would remind everybody here that the person in the presidential campaign of 1988 who introduced Willie Horton to the campaign and the American people was the current Vice President of the United States, Albert Gore. That's where Willie Horton came from. Albert Gore used it against Michael Dukakis in the New York primary. As far as issues are concerned, I think that Brian Lundy was right, a Democratic campaign consultant quoted in the USA Today. It's very reflective of the Patton campaign when he said what you're going to see is all the Democrats running as moderate Republicans. And that's what the one successful Democrat yesterday did, except Brian was not quite accurate. Paul Patton didn't run as a moderate Republican. He ran as a conservative Republican. He ran as the kind of prayer in school against gun control Democrat that my friend Chris likes to get up and talk so bad about as extremists when they happen to be Republicans who say that. For those of you who are not knowledgeable of Mississippi, there are a few of you here that are, our lieutenant governor's problem is for 3.5 years he'd had a running feud with the Republican governor. And all of us Republicans in Mississippi wish that hadn't been the case, but that was his problem, is that he was viewed as against the governor's agenda, and the Democratic lieutenant governor candidate ran to the right of him. I'm sort of like Christy Whitman today. Governor Whitman had a news conference today when she said about the Democrats in New Jersey, if the Democrats want to say us winning 50 seats and them winning 30 seats is a victory, well, that's fine with me. And if the Democrats want to say us winning 3 out of 6 and having 3 out of 5 and having 1 tie is a victory, I am willing for it to be defined that way. We're going to win 2 out of 3 governorships this year, including half the Democrats who are up. We consider that a great year. We do know a lot of people want to define success for the Democrats as the absence of catastrophe, and that's okay with me. But we're going to have to settle for just half their governors this year. On the last point, in a vein that I think is important for you and the viewers to understand, for me, these elections turned on issues that were very positive for the Republicans. That the Patton campaign ran weeks of Medicare advertising against Forgy in Kentucky, and Forgy went up so that they realized that it failed. That Patton ran as a conservative speaks a great message to me, and the message is this. The greater risk for Republicans is turning back. The greater risk for Republicans is to stop short. What we have to do is put the ball in the end zone, to do what we promised people last year we would do, to make government smaller, taxes lower, spending less, regulations fewer, have genuine welfare reform that causes people to have to go to work. The American people are not dumb. The American people understand that this economy is better despite Bill Clinton's policies, not because of Bill Clinton's policies. And economists have spoken on the Hill just in the last 7 days that interest rates are lower today and started going down in September because some people started to believe, hey, the Republicans really are going to balance the budget. And I'm here to say those people who believe that are right. Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you both for your statements and rebuttal. We have questions. It would be, Senator, if you'll stand here, we'll ask the questions of you, and they come in jointly and singly. This would be for both of you. The economy is softening, consumer debt swelling, wages not keeping pace with inflation. How will this trend impact on the voters next year?
The economy is softening. President Clinton was fortunate to inherit a very strong economy that was growing at the time he became president. And it was growing fast enough that it was able to absorb the largest tax increase in American history by just enough to slow it down, not to actually push it down into a recession. We think that the economy is endangered if we do not balance the budget. If we don't, because we know that creates more jobs, higher wages, because it creates lower interest rates, a more stable dollar. How will it affect the election? I think the Democrats can't understand why Clinton's not getting credit for a good economy. And I think, as I said earlier, the reason he's not getting credit is people think the economy is good despite his policies. And so a downturn in the economy, it's hard to say who it will help or hurt, but clearly Clinton is getting no help out of his economics policy today because most people disagree with him.
Well, I think it will help tremendously, the President. Jack Kennedy used to say, if the economy is wrong, nothing's right. And I think it was true then, it's true today. And clearly, the direction we're going in terms of reducing the size of the deficit would have been $500 billion more. Had the budget proposal last year not been adopted, might add not adopted without a single Republican vote, would have made this year that much more difficult in terms of moving us in the proper direction. The size of government itself, as a percentage of the overall workforce, the percentage of the country, this will be the smallest federal bureaucracy since when Franklin Roosevelt took over as president. We have 3 years consecutively of deficit reduction. That's the first time in almost 50 years that has occurred. And all of those things that occurred as a result of hard-fought battles, these were not easily won battles, I think have caused the markets to react as positively as they have. Had it been going in the opposite direction, then I think the President would be facing far more difficulties. I think the results of yesterday, the message would have been that we're on the wrong track economically. As it was, because the economy is moving in a strong direction, and the debate was about Medicare and Medicaid and education and the environment, and people's legitimate concerns about what this agenda may do to them, that we were able to make the gains we did. Remember, this was not a surprise election in these states. These were hard-fought battles. The Republicans were not caught flat-footed. They engaged very aggressively from New Jersey and Maine, Mississippi, Kentucky, Virginia, very aggressive campaigns. The Democrats responded by talking about these issues. And the public, I think, in these states, certainly their voting patterns yesterday, particularly in the lowercase races, reflected their concerns. So I think the president is going to benefit in 1996 as a result of the economic decisions he's made, the tough choices that are being made, and the fact that he's fighting back in Democrats on Capitol Hill over this contract and the direction it's taking us economically on the issues I've mentioned. I think if we were to give up on those issues, then we would be in trouble politically. The public wants us to fight back on them and to have a sense of balance here about our agenda. Continuing with a balanced budget, there's not an argument about that. The question of how we do it, there is a significant argument about it, and I think the public wants us to stand up and fight those battles.
This question for Mr. Barber about General Powell and his plans. Do you think that his apparent decision not to run will affect the Speaker's status in that regard in running for president? And relatedly, do you think Mr. Powell might become vice presidential delegate or candidate on the ticket, on the Republican ticket?
But first of all, I don't know what General Powell is going to announce today. It's been reported widely in the media that he's going to announce he's not running for president. That may well be true. I can't confirm it. If General Powell decides not to run for president, I have no idea whether he would want to be a candidate for vice president, whether somebody would choose him. I don't know who the presidential nominee is going to be, so I don't know how I could know who the vice presidential nominee is going to be. So as far as it affecting what Speaker Gingrich might do, I would be very surprised if Newt Gingrich were to run for president. I think it is most unlikely. But again, I don't have any inside information that you don't have.
For Senator Dodd, is there any chance someone will challenge Clinton in the primaries a la Gene McCarthy?
Let me first of all say that I endorse Newt Gingrich's candidacy for the Republican nomination. We think he'd be a fine candidate. I don't believe that the president will be challenged. In my travels around the country, I don't get any sense of that at all. That there is a strong sense the Democrats need to come together. The wake-up call of last November had a very profound effect on Democrats in terms of rallying together. One of our problems has been, in recent time, is that we've been balkanized. We've been divided and split. But the results of last fall certainly changed that. And you're going to find a very united Democratic Party. I think that was indicated yesterday by the results in these states where Democrats really rallied together. In the various states where the elections were held, that will continue. In fact, the results of yesterday, as I said earlier, will energize those people who were concerned about whether or not Democrats could win in 1996. I think the results of yesterday are going to be a tremendous lift for people at the grassroots level across the country, and I think you're going to find a tremendous support for the Clinton-Gore ticket.
Gentlemen, either one of you can also answer a question that directed at one of you. This is for both of you. Regulatory reform seems to have fizzled, even though it was a priority in the Contract with America. Will voters hold that against Republicans next year? Will the environment be an issue in the 96th presidential campaign?
I guess it's probably appropriate for me to answer that first. The House passed a very good regulatory reform bill, that takes regulatory policy in the United States and requires it to be based on sound science, that in every case for there to be risk assessment, so that as we put regulations into place that burden businesses or families, that we understand what is the risk, and that we then balance the economic cost against the regulatory achievement, that how much is it worth to spend to solve a risk that's virtually non-existent. Bill Riley is head of EPA. That one of the great problems at EPA is they had no risk assessment. They were spending billions on things that weren't a problem, and then there were things that were serious problems they were spending nothing on. So balancing economic cost against regulatory benefit is important. And finally, in regulatory policy, we must protect people's private property rights. There is a reason the Fifth Amendment's in the United States Constitution. If the government takes your property or diminishes the value of your property for the public good, then the government has to compensate you. And if it's not worth compensating you, the government ought not to take it away from you. Now, will Republicans be blamed because the House passed that and the Senate didn't? Well, no, because the Senate hadn't, because the Democrats filibustered it. It's got 59 votes in favor of it. A majority in the Senate, nearly all the Republicans, have already voted for regulatory reform. But because in the Senate 60 votes are required to get final passage, the Democrat minority, with just 41 votes, is holding up regulatory reform. So those who are for regulatory reform will not hold it against the Republicans. They'll hold it against the Democrats for keeping it from happening.
Well, let me suggest that one of the problems here, in fact, in the state of Kentucky, one of the major issues yesterday was the environmental issues and the direction dealing with power, where the notion of an extreme view on deregulation really was rebounded to the Democrats' benefit. This administration has been responsible for a reduction in 20% of the paperwork for small business, very effective in terms of working to try and reduce the kind of burdensome bureaucracy that can affect industry and business. But there is a sense of balance that must be struck here, and there is a sense and feeling in the country that this new majority in the House and the Senate are going too far on these issues. And people are concerned about what happens to their water and their air, the food they eat. And while they clearly want to see some reforms in these areas, there is this gnawing concern that given unfettered control and power, that they would strip away an awful lot of the gains that have been made in areas that people care deeply about. And so what has happened here is a failure for the Republican majority to try and strike a balance here, try and pass reform legislation that is moderate and balanced and thoughtful rather than going too far and too extreme. That has occurred in one area after another, and this is one. I would add here that the environmental issues, I would not have predicted 8 months ago or 10 months ago, would be as potent as they are. In fact, environmental issues in some parts of the country are more powerful than Medicare education because of how far the Republican majority has taken the country, or how far they've attempted to take the country in the last 7 or 8 months.
This is a divided question. You each get half. Why didn't Clinton campaign for anybody in the election yesterday? And did Speaker Gingrich campaign for anybody yesterday?
Well, certainly the Speaker did, and Bob Dole have. And I mentioned the several states where they went in and were very much a part of the campaign. And President Clinton was as well. Whether or not he was in the states, the fact of the matter is, the Republican candidates certainly tried to make him an issue. I've mentioned specifically the ads, the statements run by Larry Forgy in Kentucky, where he specifically challenged the people of Kentucky to send a message to President Clinton, specifically called for that. And certainly Lieutenant Governor, Governor-elect Patton, clearly put the President on the agenda, said where he disagreed with him, but also very forcefully talked about the Speaker's agenda on the issues that I've mentioned already, and challenged the voters of the state to make a choice, and they did. Certainly in Virginia, where the Speaker did campaign, along with Bob Dole, in a very aggressive race there, again, where the President and the agenda was on the table. The Governor of Virginia said he wanted to do for Virginia what Newt Gingrich was doing for the country, and Virginia responded in race after race. Despite the predictions this was going to be an overwhelming change and party control, they rejected that. I mentioned New York State, again, where the Speaker was very much in Staten Island in that race. Across the country, he was very much in the race, whether or not he campaigned in each state, and certainly the President was on the agenda. So whether or not they physically showed up in each and every place, these candidates, these individuals, were clearly on the minds of voters in the states that participated yesterday.
But Leader Dole and Speaker Gingrich were invited to campaign every state and campaigned in virtually every state. Several states more than once, and they helped our campaigns. The reason President Clinton wasn't asked to campaign is because, for the obvious reason, Democrats not only thought they'd hurt him, most of the Democrats were running away from him. Paul Patton did talk about Bill Clinton in the campaign. He said if Bill Clinton follows through on what he said about regulating tobacco and treating it as a narcotic, I will publicly oppose him for re-election next year. Now, that's not my idea of what the White House wanted them to interject Bill Clinton into the Kentucky campaign for, but that is exactly what they did. Look, the Democrats are very, very talented people. And they watched what happened last year. Bill Clinton went to, you remember the campaign, you know it was real close, and Clinton went over to Israel and Jordan, and they had some great photo ops, and his numbers went up in the polls. And the Democrats thought he had had a recovery. So they brought him home, and the last 9 days he campaigned all across the country with Democrats. I can see him right now, Chris, his arm around Teddy Kennedy saying, if you like what the Democrats are doing, if you like what I'm doing for the country, Bill Clinton said, vote for the Democrats. Hell, that's what I was saying. If you like what Bill Clinton's doing, vote for the Democrats. And as it turned out, everywhere he went, it hurt the Democrats. Because, and this is not hard to understand with Clinton's health care plan, the Democrats misdiagnosed that rise in the polls. They thought it was a recovery. What it actually was what doctors used to call a hectic flush. A hectic flush is back when people used to die of consumption. Just before they would rally, they'd look good, they'd recognize everybody, they'd speak, and then they'd die. And the Democrats didn't want another hectic flush on their hands.
I point out Teddy Kennedy won that race against your candidate in Massachusetts. And I'd go to see the doctor immediately because I think you're having a hectic flush here as a result of what's happening.
This question for Mr. Barber. Why do the Republicans keep pushing for a tax cut when the polls show the electorate would rather just have deficit reduction and tax reduction and Medicare spending?
Well, the Republicans are pushing for a tax cut for several reasons. One is we think it's good policy that the people who earn the money ought to get to keep more of the money they earn. The United States today has the highest income tax rate, highest tax rate in the peacetime history of the country. If you add state, federal, and local together, we've never been as taxed as we are. We think the American people need to get to keep more of what they earn. Secondly, we said in the campaign, if we ran, this is what we'd do. And we're trying to a novel approach here in Washington. We're keeping our word. We said we would do something, and we're keeping our promises. Finally, let me just dispute the polling numbers. Any poll that you see, if you ask people, which would you prefer, a balanced budget or a tax cut, people by a large margin say a balanced budget. But if you ask the question, which would you prefer, not balancing the budget, keeping like we're doing now, just balancing the budget, or balancing the budget and cutting taxes, about 60% of Americans in every poll say we ought to do both. They believe we can do both, and they're right. We can do both. You know, polling, it can be very deceiving. The New York Times published a poll last week in which they said by a 2-to-1 margin, Americans opposed the Medicare plan of the Republicans. What they did not say was in the very same poll, 88% of Americans said they didn't know a lot about what was in the Medicare plan. 88% said they didn't know a lot about what was in the plan. So all they had to go by was these Medicare ads. 75% of the people did not know, 78% did not know that Medicare spending was going up. Most people thought it was going down from below what it is today, $4,800. 27% thought it was going to be under $4,000 in 7 years, when the fact is it's going to be $6,700. Polling can be deceiving if it's not looked at in the whole. And in the whole, the American people believe Congress and the President should do both. After all, both the Congress and the President promised to balance the budget. Both the Congress and the President promised a middle-class tax cut. Both the Congress and the President promised genuine welfare reform. The difference is the Republicans are doing it, and the President is saying, if you send it over here, I'll veto it.
Well, let me, first of all, add the tax cut idea. The facts are that 51% of the American public, if this proposal becomes law, are going to have a tax increase. For people making under $30,000 a year, the earned income tax credit is going to go up for people who have incomes at that level. I believe that had the Republicans last fall really said what they were going to do, I would like to run a race where we'd stand up and say we're going to cut Medicare by $270 billion, cut Medicaid by $182 billion, slice the support for higher education in this country by $11 billion, and we're going to, by the way, have a tax cut of $245 billion, where about 50% of it goes to people who have incomes in the six-figure category. And, by the way, we're going to increase the taxes on what Ronald Reagan called the best hedge against falling back into poverty, that George Bush supported strongly, that this administration has, cutting $40 billion out of the earned income tax credit. I think you would have had a different result last fall than the one we did. But that was not the message. That's not what the Republicans ran on. And frankly, I think the results yesterday are rejection of that very agenda, the very agenda that has been suggested that the country adopt. Now, on the overall proposals in terms of direction, this administration has moved towards a balanced budget and, in fact, done it for the first time in years, on three consecutive years. And that is something that the American people, I think, are supportive of. And they want to see us continue to move in that direction. But they don't want to see a massive tax cut that goes primarily to those in the upper income category, have taxes increased on those at the lower income level. That they're opposed to. They're opposed to draconian cuts in Medicare. They're opposed to significant cuts in education. And they're really worried about where this party, the Republican Party, is taking us on environmental issues. I believe that focusing on the balanced budget, moving in that direction, is a central theme. People want to see us continue in that direction, but they want it done with a sense of balance, not going too far, not being too harsh, not going in the extreme, going to the extremes. And that's what they see coming out of this Republican majority.
A question for both of you. Republicans are pressing the case for devolution, giving the states and local communities control over programs. Many Democrats seem to agree. Do you believe that scientific research as one item and roughly a $70 billion federal item can be transferred to the states?
Well, we believe that where devolution can occur, that one will be willing to do so, and this administration has in the area of Medicaid, providing waivers to states, allowing them to experiment in these areas. But we're also not fooled by what a lot of this may mean, in effect, to try and not deal with some of these issues on a national level, where you try to maintain minimum standards, for instance, in the area of welfare reform and in Medicaid, that understand that a child in Mississippi or a child in Connecticut that's in trouble, that needs help, ought not to be abandoned by their government. And there is concern about that. Thus, we're trying to maintain the maintenance of effort standards and welfare reform, trying to maintain a minimum of standards to see to it that these children will not be left behind. And I think, again, that reflects the sense of balance, to give more local control and authority where it's appropriate and proper to do so, but not to walk away from the notion of one nation, indivisible, as we deal with these problems across the country. Certainly, wherever else we can, to try and allow states to experiment in those areas, but not to abandon our national commitment on these issues, which are critically important to the health of the country.
This is an area where there's great disagreement among us. Republicans, like most Americans, think programs like welfare and Medicaid can be run much better at the state level. Our welfare system's a disgrace, and the only people who've had any success reforming it are the governors, are the states. Medicaid is a poverty health care program, health care for the poor. I would add, we do not think the federal government shouldn't have any role. In fact, Medicaid spending under our budget will go up from $89 billion this year to $125 billion in 7 years. Now, Chris thinks that's a draconian cut because he wants it to go up to $190 billion. But it's going to go from 89 to 124, just like Medicare spending is going to go up 54%. It's the fastest growing, it grows at the fastest rate of any item in the federal government. But they consider that, as Chris said, a draconian cut, even though we'll go from spending $4,800 for each senior citizen a year to more than $6,700 for each senior citizen per year. The same is true of the earned income tax credit. The earned income tax credit goes up. More money goes up. Student loans go up from $24 billion of student loans in effect this year to $36 billion in effect. We like the states running those programs because they don't need remedial arithmetic like the people do in Washington, D.C. They know a 54% increase in Medicare spending means it's going up, not down. You can't turn your money over to people that can't count.
It's time for our last question, but before that, let me, I failed to introduce two people at our head table, and let me do that now. Chuck Lewis, Washington Bureau Chief, Hearst Newspapers. And Robin Spruill, Washington Bureau Chief, ABC News. I'm sorry, I missed it. Before the last question, gentlemen, we have certificates of appreciation for each of you here. As they say, same thing. And your
congratulations to Democrats.
And for your morning cup of coffee.
Thank you very much.
And now the last question. Did either of you have wagers on Colin Powell's decision?
No.
Yes.
¿Cómo que no habla español? Que yo iba a hacer el debate en español. Que había alguna persona que hablaba, pero... Sí, como no, claro, sería mejor en español.
¿Qué dice?
Well, I think it crystallizes in the Republicans and Congress. They've been fighting so hard, very much the only agenda to vote on. Powell denied that agenda. It's been too hard, too far. And then they're so muted that debate. So now Hardigan and Dole and others can't run away from the very agenda they fought very hard for. Given the results yesterday in some of these states, I think there was a very clear rejection, people in the under-ticket. People voted overwhelmingly for Democrats in some states where they were told they had no chance whatsoever. I think that's an important and positive message for Democrats. We'll come back in 6, should Bob Dole probably be leading that ticket. It's going to make it much harder for them to get anywhere. I think it's a clearer
message.
Yeah, Gene, how are you?
Nice to see you.
Glad you're here today.
Enjoyed it.
Great. Well, I had a lot of fun, and we sent up that crusader from Connecticut speech to our article to the library.
Good. And, I saw the piece in the paper, wrote a note, put it on, I got three huge boxes.